Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
This is Jessica with Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast, and I am really excited to have our guest today. Please introduce yourself and tell us about yourself.
Well, my name is Hector Gonzalez. I am I want to call myself a baby old writer. I decided to start writing again after a lot of years. I'm 47 years old. I was born in Mexico City. I'm queer, non-binary, and can use he, him, or also they, them. I go with he, him, giving the grace to the people to see, oh, okay, but also you can use they in this case, the situations. And I'm a big admirer of Michael Ende, that only thanks to you, I have all my life, because I initially read him in Spanish, always call him Michael Ende, but then I said, oh, yeah. His name is in German. That's important.
Right. When I was doing my research into him, I kind of like went through a few of those things that you do where like you like, okay, how do I pronounce that? And that's how the anglicized version of it. And you're also a writer, correct?
That is correct. I write a little bit on the side, like many other people. And I feel that I'm kind of returning to it. In 2018, I replied to a call online. The artist John Picasso was chosen to be the guest of honor for WorldCon. And he thought there is a lack of representation of Mexican talent there. So he said, I'm sponsoring 4 participants to come to the WorldCon. You just need to contact me, say why would you be interested. And to me, it was one of those things like, why not? Send a message, told him about my interest, what the important. Then we have a conversation over the phone. And he said, you know what? You're chosen. And thankfully, the sci-fi community, not only John, but also John Scalzi, Mary Robinette Kowal, and many other writers and creators, they started saying, okay, let me match you. At the end, they chose 50 participants, and all of us, well, not all of us managed to go there, but the ones that we went, we participated in panels, we shared our experiences. I had the honor of making tacos de carnitas for the writers, among them George R.R. Martin. So it was this kind of weird situation and experience. And because I love cooking, but at the same time, I'm very nerdy, I made 7 different salsas based and inspired by sci-fi. So, ooh. And each one of them hotter and hotter. So the plainest one, it was Picard de Gallo.
Very then, cute. I love the pun. That's a good one.
Oh, it was. That was the idea. Then we had also Soylent Verde. We continued with, let's see, Obi-Juan Chipotle. And continued. The spices one was Dracarys, that was made with ghost peppers and whatnot. I had also the one that I felt very proud of, it was I made the spice. I made the melange sauce that it was completely blue. That was a thing that I'm very, very proud of, and especially that if you added some citrus, it also changed colors. So as a sci-fi enthusiast, I was very, very pleased with my nerdiness, honestly.
That's awesome, and not even a fraction of what we're going to talk about today, but I learned a whole new world about salsa nerdiness. So let's dive into the book that sort of brought us together to do this chat. So back in, I believe, towards the end of April, we released an episode with Sarah Marshall from Wire Dads and You're Wrong About, where we talked about the Neverending Story, the book and the movie and trauma, and also the author of who you mentioned before, Michael Ende, or Und, as it would be pronounced in German. And by far, because the movie is still such a sci-fi, you know, like a pop culture hit in the US, and so many people were drawn in by you know, like all of the sadness and the, you know, things that were portrayed in that, people are familiar with his book, The Neverending Story, which is an epic. And I don't even know if we got to mention this in the podcast episode. The movie ends at the halfway point of the book, and there's a whole other thing that happens that we don't have time to go into in the book, but I urge everybody to read it because it really turns Bastian's story on its head and sort of inverts the original, the first part of the story. But as a librarian, I worked in children's for 15 years, and there was always one other book of his that was filed next to Neverending Story, and it was called Momo. And I always meant to get around to reading it. And then when we posted the Neverending Story podcast episode, you reached out and said, hey, this book means a lot to me, and I wrote an essay about it, which is what we're here to talk about.
And I'm happy to chat about Momo. Momo, what I say, it's a very comfort read, a big comfort read for me, because it reminds me about different things that are important for a person. And it will, I mean, do we want to do like a full spoiler about the story, or do we want to be a little bit coy about the main
thing? We can be coy because I think, like I said, a lot of people are exposed at least to the background story of the Neverending Story, whether they came at it from reading the book first or they're familiar with the movie. So they know that there's lots of sadness within, and they know the spoilers. It's like, what is it? Like Darth Vader is Luke's father. You can't, like, that's not a spoiler at this point. But Momo, we're really hoping for people to pick this one up, because I am floored that this book has not received the recognition that other children's books of its time has. So let's be coy.
So to start, my experience with Momo, I read it initially in Spanish, thanks to my friend Aline. And initially, Aline lent me the book, and I didn't even read it. I was living the rat race in the 90s of being on the dot-com bubble, trying to sell websites, do all kind of stuff. And that was my life. And when everything came crashing down, I was just pretty much cleaning around, and I found her book. And I thought, well, let's read it this time. And thing after thing that you read in the book, to me, it was so beautiful. And I don't know, I think that even with the job that it is translating, because it's a German novel, and with translation, usually you do an adaptation of what you think the writer was trying to convey on that. And about maybe 20% of the initial meaning gets lost. But the meaning that I got from this, it was the value of community, the uniqueness of your imagination, the fascinating rules that we follow that sometimes we don't even understand why, the dangers of commercialism, and more importantly, a complete condemnation of hustle culture. And this is in 1973. He released that at that time, and he saw it. And that's a part that it is so lovely about this book also, because he tries to show you how these things, how these forces are affecting you. And how, at one moment, you also have the capacity of saying, these are the kind of things that I want to change. How do I change them? How do I find the way to reconnect to these kind of situations? And it's, in certain ways, it's a little bit of an anarchist book, because it tells you the rules created by these systems are possible to destroy. You just need to find the ways. And this goes also with the past of Michael, how he lived and also the kind of things that he studied later in his life. And that's a little bit of a spoiler about him, but he was working especially with Japanese economists on one important thing. We know a lot about how to change, how can I say it, current policies, but he was working with them to understand the origins of capitalism and understand, okay, how did this happen? How did it start? How can we manage to, can it be reformed? Can it be re-understood? Can it be reshaped into something that will be more helpful for everyone? And that was one of the things that he did. And you think, oh, it was just, he was just a children's book author. No, not at all.
Not at all. And I think he sort of pushed back against being penned in as a children's book author, and not because he thought there was anything wrong with it. More, I think that like society sort of devalues it as you're just a children's book author, you know, or just valued what, you know, fantasy and what is considered children's things and putting away, you know, like you, when I was no longer a child, I put away my childish things. And that to him, I think in general, he didn't seem to jive with that at all. So I think this is one of those books. I think Michael himself said something like his books are for children 80 to 8, I think was the quote, or 8 to 80. This is one of those books, and especially reading it coming out of the pandemic, it struck a real chord with me. So did you want to talk a little bit about the spoiler-free plot of Momo?
So we start on a town, and they don't give you a place. They tell you that it is one of those towns that has a story behind them, and there is an amphitheater, one of those old Greek theaters where it's just a half moon of seats, and the scenario that you can see the show. And there is this girl that appears, Momo. And nobody knows where she came from. She's a little bit of a mystery. Everybody's like, well, where are you coming from? And the way that Michael describes Momo, and even in English, I read this in Spanish, and in English, even the way that he describes her, it's, I have to say, he does it with so much kindness and beauty that I just love that. And let me read from here. Momo looked more than a little bizarre, and her appearance could easily shock the kind of people who hold cleanliness and neatness in high regard. She was so small and skinny that people couldn't tell, even when they tried their hardest, whether she was 8 or already 12. She had a wild, jet black mop of curly hair that looked like it had never been touched by brush or scissors. She had large, beautiful obsidian eyes. And because she was always barefoot, she had black feet the same color as her hair. She sometimes wore shoes in the winter, but it was a mismatched pair that was much too big for her. This was because Momo didn't own anything apart from what she found laying around or had been given as a gift. Her skirt was made of many different colorful swatches of fabric sewn together, and it reached all the way down to her ankles. She wore an old men's jacket on top of that, which was much too wide for her, and she rolled the sleeves up at her wrists. As a precaution, Mom hadn't cut the sleeves because she wisely recognized that she would probably still grow. And who knew if she would ever find such a beautiful and practical jacket with so many pockets. And that description, what I like, it's the elegance and the details about it. He creates these sentences that evokes her, but at the same time, gives you a little bit the compassion about the kind of life and experiences that she has gone through, and humanizes also all the other people that then. There is internationally, I think, this debate about how to deal with homelessness. That at one moment, how to describe someone that is homeless and understanding the kind of pain that they are going through. We don't know a lot of the past pain of Momo, but makes you a little bit feel, what if all these homeless people are also children? What will you do?
Yeah, I really liked that. And it was almost like she was, you know, she was dropped into this story, but fully formed, you know, like the goddess Athena leaping from Zeus's head. She was just there. And we got to perceive her as the townspeople got to perceive her. We got to know her as they got to know her. And I think this was one of those things where less background was more.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't need to. There was a little bit of a hint as to some, you know, something she might have dealt with in the past, as far as, you know, like being an orphan living on the street. You know, but they don't really, it's not really gone into. It's just sort of like, well, why don't you, you know, look for a children's home, and this is why not. And that's the end of it. And we don't need to know anymore, because the town decides that she's going to be theirs, and she heals them in ways that they didn't realize they needed. Like, she fills a void that they didn't realize they had. And it is so lovely.
Exactly. And this is the part that when I was rereading it, as I mentioned, I read it initially in Spanish, and this is, I think, my third time that I had read it in English. And at the start of the book, Michael tells you, this is how I see a beautiful society will work. And let me read about it. After they decided, well, you're living here in the amphitheater, so let's make the best of it. They immediately began to help by cleaning up Momo's dilapidated stone dungeon and making it as habitable as possible. One of them, a bricklayer, even built Momo a small stone stove, somehow producing a rusty stovepipe to go along with it. An old carpenter nailed a few crate boards together to make a small table and two chairs. Finally, some women brought a rusted iron bed frame ornamented with curlicues, a mattress that was only a little ripped, and two blankets. Last of all, the bricklayer, who was also a little bit of an artist, painted a pretty flower painting on the wall. He even painted a pretend frame around it and pretend nails. Suddenly, the stone hole under the stage of ruin had become a cozy little room. The value of community. I mean, this is the part that you see that someone's struggling and everybody just gets together and say, I have this talent, let me see how I can help. And we are seeing also these sort of kind of inklings of community support on these days. We're creating these communities online where we reach to each other and we try to see, well, if I'm nearby, let me help you. Or they try to say, how can I best assist you when you are roughing it?
Yeah, it was really beautiful. I just, like, the language and just the care in everything. And again, this is a translation, so I see mm-hmm. what you're saying. And my sister-in-law is actually a translator as well, so I have a little bit of insider knowledge into how it all works. And, you know, it is difficult to sort of put nuance in, but it is lovely. It's so beautiful. And I really just adored reading it. It was like almost like taking a breath.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is kind of like the idyllic beginning where mm-hmm. Momo, you know, she's really healing the townspeople because they're going about their lives and they realize she has a sympathetic ear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she just listens. And in just sort of existing as somebody to listen, she helps them a lot. And she also is like a beacon of light for the children in the mm-hmm. town, because the children are all really into imaginative play and Momo is there for it.
And that's a beautiful part that, I mean, they discovered that the basis of entertainment, of enjoyment, it's not having things. It's just, okay, let's create something. Let's create our own adventures from what we have read, with what we have imagined. They are using what they have around, and it's just sticks, stones, and a setting. And then they create their own shape with a storm and everything. And at the end, everybody's like, oh, we need to do this again. But different adventures and continue. And that's the idea of creation, imagination. And we don't value that as what children do for on that matter. We see them, oh, they are just playing. No, they are creating in ways that we just, it's almost like, oh, I want to start doing something. You just say, oh, yeah, yeah, you're doing something. No, keep feeding that. Keep allowing it to grow and grow and grow. And let's see where it goes.
This is the beginning. And the story veers off into something that I thought was relevant in this time and in every time, but I'm going to say in this time specifically, because I think when the world shut down, a lot of us who, especially those who hustle like myself, because I'm always in the middle of five things. And it almost makes me think of that quote from Alice in Wonderland, something like, I think of like seven impossible things before breakfast, or it might be more than that, but you know, just like your mind is always working. You know, I like to say, it's like, oh no, I do seven impossible tasks before breakfast or my second cup of coffee, because we're kind of wired that way. Mm-hmm. Especially with social media, which I can't knock 100%, otherwise we would not be having this conversation, but everything is so instantaneous. And you know, there's a 24-hour news cycle, we're always watching that now, we're always plugged in. And I know this has been kind of looked at in so many ways, but this book brought it into a children's book in a very good way, I think, that children and adults can sort of internalize. When the pandemic hit, you know, I'm a mom of two young children, and I was working from home, my husband was working from home, and we kind of got to see their day in a different way and realize that there's missing time. And it's not so much the fact that they're missing time because school is bad and they should be home all the time, but just more how they spend their time versus how we spend our time versus how we spend our time together. Momo comes into contact, or rather her town is sort of descended upon by these shadowy figures, these gray gentlemen, gray men, it depends on the translation, and they approach the townspeople saying that they're from the Time Savings Bank and talk about how they're investing their time. And it's so smart.
And the idea is that we see it even to these days. We hear all these kind of success gurus that tell you, hey, you only have 24 hours a day and you spend 8 sleeping. You're wasting that time. You need to do all this and that. But I think that nobody ever takes into account the part of, well, what if we created some systems that helps you not having to hustle so much and not having to think so much into this kind of resource? And that was an interesting kind of situation. We see time as a resource. We see it as a very limited one because we have a lifetime. But at the same time, the gray man makes you believe, oh, if you are not maximizing your time, then you're not doing the best for you. And they create this illusion. And that's a part that when you start analyzing it, they tell you, oh, if you don't put this time for the end of when you are retired, you will never enjoy it. How does that sound?
And that's the thing. What about the time that you're spending now? I mean, what about, it was like, oh, you're spending too much time with your elderly mother, so you need to not spend time with your elderly mother. But then when that person is gone, you can't get that time back. So it, like, I'm like reading this book and I'm like, oh my God. Wow.
And I mean, the way that they put it, also they put tables in there telling you that the exact times that you're spending with everyone. And they create this trick that I have seen in statistics, economists and everyone. They put big numbers. And the idea of making something feel humongous, feeling that it's so exorbitant, it's something that needs to be done better. And I don't want to pretty much say that it's not the truth in all the situations, but that's the way also that not everyone is so keen to digesting big numbers. And that creates the possibility of somebody tells you, hey, you're misusing this number. There is the part of you that, oh, are they really telling the truth on this? Am I understanding this correctly? They must be smart. So I am not understanding this correctly. And they sell you the idea of something that actually it's not something healthy for you. And it's interesting how Michael managed to create these enemies that more than anything, it was societal forces that telling you, hey, you need to continue hustling because that's how you're doing. But it should be more on the part of why don't we create a culture where hustle is not necessary, where we don't need to save time.
I finished this book and I don't really understand why we have not adapted this into all of these children's books that we call classics. Mm-hmm. I'm reading it and I was thinking back to when I read like A Wrinkle in Time the first time. And that's a very widely known book. And, you know, it deals a little bit with like society, but in a different way. But there's, you know, I saw some places where they were kind of sort of touching, but I couldn't understand why this, you know, to me this is like akin to somebody like, oh, you liked this, have you read Momo, have you go see, why don't you go see Momo, which is the refrain in the book before the gray men take in. We in this country like study, you know, when we're studying children's literature as a librarian or when we're a child and we're given a reading list of, you know, suggested reading books to read, there's like five Roald Dahl books on that list. And there's Anne of Green Gables. There's sometimes you get Pippi Longstocking. But I don't understand why Momo did not get picked up like that, because first of all, I think children would love it. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, and adults should read it too, as we're talking about right now. I think that it just amazed me that it sat, and I hate to say, collected dust on the library shelf next to The NeverEnding Story, which you would get people taking out, but it did not get adapted as one of these great classics that every elementary school in the country is telling their kids to read. Do you have thoughts about that?
I have. I mean, for Mexico, it's so peculiar, especially about the books, international books that we get. I mean, we got the Harry Potter books, of course, because they were selling like pancakes and people like money. So booksellers in Mexico, when the editorial companies, they decided that they wanted nice things, and that's why they brought them. But why some of these other titles came, to me, it's a little bit surprising, because this is a title that it's telling you to fight about commercialism. It's telling you about how your community on its own can also do great things by itself. And makes me understand maybe a little bit that the buyers, they use, these titles are selling well in these countries. I think that we can, and somebody said, well, let's get a translation there and see how it works. I haven't managed to find numbers on book sales internationally in Latin America for this book, but from the friends that I have chatted to, they say, oh yeah, we have read this book and we like it. But here in the United States, if somebody thinks about Momo, they think about this viral challenge that happened about a couple of years ago. And to me, it was so disheartening how they were all saying it. And from my small pulpit online on Twitter, I started saying, oh, no, the Momo, you want a good Momo challenge? Read this book. And I was putting all the possible links to it. And I think that when it got translated into English, instead of going with Momo, because people, I don't know, the editorials, they said, oh, that main name doesn't make sense. They just decided to translate it, The Gray Men. Yeah, how many children, they are like, oh, mom, can I get the book of the children, the Gray Men?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, Momo versus the Gray Men,
yeah,
which is like a real simplification as to what happens in the story, because they target her. And I don't want to veer too much into spoilers. There's grief in this, which is, I wasn't sure whether it was going to be the searing grief that happened in the Neverending Story. It's a very different grief, which is great, because that is a real tribute to Michael and how he can sort of run the gamut and write things sensitively in both, like, you know, like we're going to dive into utter despair and then we're going to dive into, you know, just like this overall sadness and grief, but it's not the same thing, but they're both valid.
It's the grief of friendships.
Yes, and
I exactly. want everyone to tell me how guilty or how at one moment we feel a little bit weird when we are like, oh, we cannot hang together because I have a second shift at the restaurant, or I need to do all this and that and everything. And that's one of the things that also the Gray Men at one moment do, that stops that valuable time that you spend with the people that you care about.
And it's
painful.
And the title of the book, I mean, it's Momo's story. You can't take it away from her by focusing it on the Gray Men. So before we end, no pun intended. Man, it's so hard not to do that.
Fun fact, when I was, before, when I tried to write a little bit in Mexico, my pen name, because I love Michael so much, I decided to name myself Hector Finis. But it was another way to go with the endings and everything. And I thought that, because a spoiler with Michael, and this one, he just puts Ende and his last name as, and this is the end. And I thought, like, well, let's do the same thing, like finish whenever I just finish a story or anything. And rethinking it, because my name, Hector Gonzalez, is very common. So if at that moment I make it as a writer, oh, marketing will have a field day with that one.
I really just really hope people pick this book up, whether you're listening to this podcast. One of the things that I thought was struck me, because, you know, sometimes, a lot of times, because I was a big consumer of media as a child, this book was adapted into a movie. And unlike the Neverending Story, Michael had a lot of say in this and actually made a cameo in it himself. I was also thinking, because he did do a lot of work in Japan, how many, you know, there's a lot of quiet novels that are adapted into like Studio Ghibli. And I feel like this would be a great one in general. When Studio Ghibli, a lot said about like the way that they portray food, and it's like these quiet moments where people are eating together. There's a lot of silence, but interaction at the same time, like just gazes or grunts within their films. And I'm like reading this and I'm like, man, if they're looking for a film to adapt, you know, another children's book to adapt, because I know that they did like Arrietty and others, I'm like, this maybe, because I know that the European adaption didn't really take over here, but everybody loves Studio Ghibli these days. I feel like this one would be a natural.
Fun fact, I mentioned before when we were exchanging emails that I'm also into anime, and my favorite Studio Ghibli movies are both Nausicaa and Porco Rosso. Porco Rosso inspired me so much that I learned how to fly a plane, because I took a trip to Italy in 2019, and my goal was pretty much fly a plane over the Mediterranean. sadly the weather was terrible, so that didn't happen. But in general, I mean, I live my substitute best life with that. And because I had this love also for Momo, I managed to chat with a friend that also sold a lot into anime, and he said that he knew Japanese. And I said, can you ask, can we send an email? Well, not an email. Can we send a letter to the studio telling them, have you considered adapting Momo? We never got a reply at all, but I had that going for me that, okay, I believe so much that it could have been one of the best Ghibli movies if they have decided to do a little bit of, if they went for it. Maybe they saw that letter and said, like, who wrote this? It's, I don't know, that are they just jumbling kanji together? I don't know, but maybe it's time to contact again the studio and see what they say.
Well, then we could say, like, hey, you heard it here first. But seriously, I mean, if it's not on their radar, it should be. Mm-hmm. Because it's got a lot of grief in it, like we were talking about. And the idea of, you know, Momo's family is her community. And we didn't even talk about her two friends, Beppo and Guido, mm-hmm. or Gigi, depending on the translation you're reading.
Yeah.
But her family was her friends and the children and the people she supported and who supported her. And the alienation from them is really, it's heartbreaking. And there's a turtle. So mm-hmm. Read it if you like turtles, and, you know, read it for the turtle. This turtle is very different from Morla, but I think you will still find her very endearing. Morla's like the grandmother who's like, you're like, oh man,
mm-hmm.
you're all kind of grumpy. And Cassiopeia is completely different, but I loved her. This is such a natural Ghibli adaptation. I was like screaming it while I'm reading the book.
And thinking about another studio that would be great adapting it, Laika.
Oh, Laika. Laika would, that would actually be amazing. Laika is a completely different, because, and what's great about them is I think they still do the hand animation, the hand for stop motion, which takes time. And if Momo is about anything, it's about
time.
Yeah.
Do we know anyone there? Do I do the same thing that I did here, that contact someone from Laika? Hey, here, I have a story idea. How do I pitch it? And let's see if what happens there. I mean, that I have been working through that system that maybe, okay, let's give it a shot. Worst thing that they can tell me, it's no. And I'll feel sad about that for a moment. And then let's try something else. Lessons that, I mean, simplifying the lessons about Momo, to me, it's your time may feel limited, but I think that you can make the best of it without feeling that you're killing yourself.
Agreed.
And that's the important thing, that the gray men create this kind of urgency of, oh, you need to save time and every time and every moment, and to the way of limiting your wellness, your balance, your health. Why? Mm. And I know that right now we are also facing the societal forces that, yeah, sometimes you need to hustle, because if not, how do you eat the next time? How do you feed your loved ones? How do you find a place to live? And we have this kind of fear about falling through the cracks. And I'm telling you, one of the biggest fears that I have myself as a Mexican immigrant that has tried to get his citizenship sorted out for some time. I'm a legal resident, but at the same time, I know that if I'm one moment I fall through the cracks, it will be catastrophic for me. And I think nobody should live with this kind of fear.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to thank you so much for coming on and chatting about this, and maybe we'll be chatting with Laika or Studio Ghibli in another like 3 years about like, hey, that was a really good idea. Or maybe they'll be like, yeah, we were already planning on it. So once again, this was Jessica with Syosset Libraries Turn the Page podcast, and our guest today was
Hector Gonzalez, writer, cook, and I call myself a Juan of all trades.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.